This episode is made possible by the Napa Valley Wine Expert Course. The Napa Valley Wine Expert Course is the only professional certification that focuses solely on the wines and wine regions of Napa Valley. If you work with or have a love of wines of the Napa Valley, the Napa Valley Wine Expert Course is your opportunity to gain a deeper understanding of one of the world's top wine regions and an industry-recognized certification. Master the wine and wine regions of the Napa Valley today. More information under NapaValleyWineAcademy.com. That is NapaValleyWineAcademy.com.
Every credential that you get makes you realize how little you really know. And I would say that's true about the Master of Wine as well. You realize that this is just the jumping off point and the mastery comes later.
From Napa Valley Wine Academy, it's The Stories Behind Wine, a show about the people, places, and stories that influence the world of wine. Today, I sit down with Mary Margaret McCamick, one of only 45 masters of wine residing in the United States, of whom only 16 are women. She became a master of wine in 2016 and is the recipient of two prestigious awards for her performance on the Master of Wine exam, earning both the Bollinger Medal for Outstanding Tasting Ability and the Overall Achievement Award for being the top student in her graduating class.
My name is Mary Margaret McCamick, and I have sort of two jobs. I am the sales manager at Screaming Eagle Vineyards here in Napa, and I'm also the general manager of a company called Careless Wine Imports, which is under the same sort of family of vineyards that imports Bonneau de Martre into the United States, and we streamline the sales direct-to-consumer of Bonneau de Martre in the U.S.
Wow. Busy.
Yes, very busy.
Very good.
But all wonderful. So.
So you're originally from North Carolina, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you attended UNC Chapel Hill. What did you study at UNC?
So, yes, a very proud Tar Heel. And I was an English major and a creative writing minor. And then I also got my master's degree there in teaching through the School of Education. And I was a swimmer.
How do you transition from English and getting your master's in teaching to taking a left turn and entering the wine industry?
Well, this is a question that a lot of people ask who have never been high school English teachers. I joke. I loved teaching, but I taught in rural North Carolina, 9th, 10th, and 12th grade English literature. And I loved the students and I loved the act of teaching, but it was very stressful. Any teachers listening know that teaching is one of the hardest jobs that exists in this country, in my opinion. It was circa 06, 07, 08. So it was a difficult time for the politics of education, to be quite frank. And wine was a release for me. And very early on, I started working part-time at a wine shop on the weekends, just after school on Fridays, and then after I was teaching school, not after I went to school, but and then on Saturdays I would go work part-time, and then on Sundays too. And it was honestly the best stress relief I had. I got to just think about wine, and I discovered that wine was pretty much everything. I mean, it combines business and sociology and history and a little bit of romance and chemistry and all of those things, and I realized that I really loved studying it.
That's great. And at this time, you moved to New York, right, in 2008, I believe?
2008. I can't remember the exact month. I think it was April. And it was a young life crisis, I call it. But I just knew that if I didn't try to transition into the wine industry and take a go at it, then I would regret it for the rest of my life. And I could not be happier that I made that transition. So, yeah, I moved up to New York and I started working. I was a cellar rat at Balthazar. That was one of my many jobs that I had in New York, because the rent was so high that, you know, many people have to work many jobs. But I worked as a cellar rat at Balthazar, technically as an intern, during the day. And then at night, I would wait tables at Tribeca Grill. And so that was sort of how I got started. And then I ultimately became the cellar master at Balthazar.
That's a pretty iconic place.
Yes, a lot of great people have gone through there. And I had some of the best teachers and mentors there I could have asked for. Chris Goodart, who sort of a legend, he worked with Kevin Zraley at Windows on the World. And Rebecca Banks, who's still there and manages all of Keith McNally's restaurants. And she's the one that encouraged me to do the WSET. So I had, you know, there's lots of different certifications and a lot of people were doing different things at the time. And she was the one that said, based on your background and based on how you relate to wine, I think you would really like this.
And you think it was the right track?
Because oh, yes.
You could have chosen Court of Master Sommeliers or some other.
It meshed with how I thought, how my brain works. And it was the perfect, I also knew I wanted to do the Master of Wine program. So it was the right path for me. Absolutely.
Turns out it was the right path, right? Because you end up graduating in 2011 mm-hmm. with your diploma.
Yes.
And not only do you graduate, you get the highest score in North America or the U.S., right?
That's true.
No easy feat. What do you attribute that to?
I really think it's like, I enjoyed the studying part. I think you can't really, it's really easy to get good at something if you enjoy it. And I say that with complete sincerity. I enjoyed studying. It was a release for me. But I would say the other thing is that I started studying for the WSET knowing that I wanted to do the MW. So it's sort of like, I haven't personally talked to Michael Phelps about this, but I can guess that if you asked him if his goal was to make the Olympics, he would say no. His goal was always to win an Olympic gold medal. And if your goal is much higher than what you actually have to achieve, you really push yourself beyond what you need to do. So for me, the WSET diploma was training ground for the MW. So I didn't want to just pass or just know something. I wanted to know it as well as I possibly could. And I think ultimately that's why I did so well, because, you know, I was really training for something beyond that.
You think your swimming career helped you in that you swam in college to make you?
Yes. Makes you very good at time management. I mean, I swam twice a day for about 15 years of my life, like morning practices, afternoon practices. I guess that's not true. It wasn't two a day for 15 years. I guess maybe more two a day for like 9 years. But when you get very little sleep and you have to go swim and then go to class and also study and get good grades, you really learn how to manage your time well. And so swimming, I attribute that to almost all of my success as an adult in my career or in wine, because it taught me self-discipline.
That's great. That's great. How did your life change after getting the diploma? Did things change for you, or did you just all of a sudden have more free time on your hands?
I think that it made me realize how much more I had to learn and how much more I wanted to learn, because I think this is one of the beautiful things with wine, right? Like every credential that you get makes you realize how little you really know. And I would say that's true about the Master of Wine as well. You realize that this is just the jumping off point and the mastery comes later. And you have, I mean, the mastery exists when you sit the exam. Obviously, you have to know so much, but it's that sort of old saying, you know, the more you learn, the less you know. I really think that's true. So for me, the diploma was invigorating and it made me think, okay, I want to keep studying. But I guess it brought some level of recognition professionally. People were, you know, impressed with what I'd achieved and realized that it meant I knew an awful lot about wine, but it didn't change so much. I mean, I still had to decide what exactly I wanted to do with it.
And did you go right on to the MW or did you take a break?
I took a year off. I took 1 year off. I the award I won allowed me to travel to Australia. So I went to Australia for 2 weeks, but that was invigorating and made me come back and think about what I wanted to do. And I wanted to take the year to really consider. I thought maybe I needed to prep to apply for the Master of Wine. And so I just took some time and thought about what I wanted to do. And then a very good friend and mentor, Sherry Sotomorano, just before the applications opened in July of 2013, I think, she said, they're open if you want to do it. And so I thought, all right, maybe this is a sign. I'm just going to dive in and see if it's the right time for me.
So what did you hope to accomplish? I mean, you're obviously a person who likes to set lofty goals, right? And not only do you set them, but you achieve them, mm-hmm. which is great. What's your next goal? You've achieved the MW, right? And this is a twofold question. What did you hope to achieve mm-hmm. with the MW, and have you achieved it?
Oh, what I hoped to achieve, this is a hard question, Christian.
Supposed to be.
So I hoped to enrich myself through the MW journey and really challenge myself and find a way to help me better think about how I can contribute to the industry. And I think I found that. I'm really happy with the way I'm able to contribute and use my knowledge now. I think there's there's much more to be done. I think the real answer to that is I'm not exactly sure yet. I don't know what the next thing I want to do is. I think exposing people to the nuance of wine education and sort of the depth and breadth of knowledge that there is to know about wine is really important to me. So that comes through in teaching or talking about, you know, where I work or just sort of that I have a unique perspective on the global business of wine. And I've sort of realized that I can give back in that sense. But where exactly this will lead, I don't know. I think I have a lot of ideas, but to be continued. Ask me again in a few years.
I'm sure it's opened a lot of opportunities, right? Now it's like the agony of choice almost.
There's a lot of choices, yes. I think it definitely has earned me some respect. You know, as a young woman walking in a room, a lot of people I think are a little bit surprised. So, but you know, I hope that a short period of time talking with me, they're less surprised. But it's opened a lot of doors, and I think it's earned me a voice in the room.
So, you segued really nicely into my next question. So, you've achieved the MW, and you visit a wine region now. Do doors just fly open for you, and they say, "Oh, here comes Mary Margaret MW"? And how does that look?
I think that there's a lot of respect for the credential. So if you come as a master of wine, people know that you're there for a serious reason, that you're going to ask good questions, that you're really interested in the nuts and bolts of how their business works and what they're doing that's sort of cutting edge or what they're doing that's traditional and why they continue to do it and not sort of adapt. I would say for the most part, absolutely, people are very respectful. But I don't think it's different than, say, a person with a great many years in the wine business who has made a name for themselves in that way. I mean, wineries typically want to share, and if they can, you know, they want to talk to intelligent people who are asking bigger questions. So I think that the MW ensures that they're going to get that when they let people come as guests. So I've been very grateful for that because, yes, it definitely gives you a different experience sometimes. They know they can talk about deeper subjects.
Right.
You know, and you don't feel like you're the annoying kid in the back of the room always raising your hand asking about, you know, as an MW student, you sort of have to be that annoying kid in the back of the room, like, well, what type of rootstock is this? And what clone is this? And why did you choose that? And, what you know, all of these sorts of things. I actually ask fewer questions like that as an MW. I think my questions tend to circle more around the business of wine these days and sort of style and marketing questions. I think it's interesting. One of the things that I find most interesting to ask about is, you know, who's drinking your wine? What's the biggest market and why do you think that is? Yeah. The psychology of why people drink what they drink is really fascinating to me. And I don't know that producers can actually answer that question. We'd have to ask the consumers themselves, but they have producers sometimes have a unique insight into what is moving the dial for their particular style of wine.
Yeah. The questions they should be asking themselves, right?
Yeah. I think a lot of them are. I hope. Yeah.
People have to find sitting down at a table or a tasting with you a little bit intimidating, right?
Because I hope not.
You know, sitting across from someone who's so accomplished as yourself, ordering a bottle of wine or enjoying wine. Do you find that to be the case? Do you find that people are a little hesitant and hold back around you?
I don't think so. I think that being a teacher and I genuinely like to hear other people's perspectives, and I think I make that pretty clear early on. I hope people aren't intimidated because that's not the purpose, right? Like, I'm always a bit skeptical of people who use wine to intimidate other people because that's really not the purpose at all. To be honest, I think most people, when I come and sit at a restaurant, they have no idea, and they give the wine list to my fiance instead and let him choose. And then when they leave, he quietly puts it over on my side, which is humorous for me because Peter, in his own right, is extremely accomplished in the world of wine and has every right to be making the same decisions that I do. It usually becomes a negotiation is how it works. Or we both get a wine list and then we consult afterwards. But I would hope that there's no intimidation factor. I try to approach things like as a teacher. Teacher, mm-hmm. Or as a guide,
right.
You know, to help people move their wine journey along.
That's right.
Because I had that. I was lucky enough to have humble generous mentors. And I think that giving back is one of the best. You have to do that.
Who is the most profound mentor that you had or that impacted your career the most, would you say?
Well, I would say there's I've been lucky enough to have several. The first two were Chris Goodart and Rebecca Banks, and they were at Balthazar. And I think that, you know, as an intern, they let me have a place at the table when they tasted with distributors and made buying decisions. And they actually listened to my opinions, even though I was very green and new to everything. And then I would say it's without question Peter Marks, who you know well and obviously teaches at Napa Valley Wine Academy and is just such an accomplished, incredible human being, and also happens to be one of the most talented tasters I've ever met in my life. And he is one of the masters of wine who helped a lot of us train in tasting. And I think what always struck me about Peter was that he was so generous with his time, so humble, and yet so incredibly knowledgeable. And so I was very lucky to have him help me along the way. So I would say those three people have made, and many, many others. I mean, you know, it feels like the Grammys, like, you know. And let me think.
I won't cut you off. I won't start playing music. Yeah,
music. Pull me off.
Well, it takes a lot of people, right? I mean, it is a solo endeavor, but you need the support of many people,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, you have to have the self-belief. I mean, at the end of the day, you're sitting there taking the exam or, you know, tasting by yourself. But it helps to have other people believe in you, too. And it helps to have learned from them. I think the biggest mistake people make as they go through the wine industry is not asking enough questions, being so worried that someone's going to think you don't know something, that you miss an opportunity to learn something. And so... Anyway, I think, yeah, having people support you and believe in you makes a big, big difference. But ultimately, it comes down to you because you have to answer the questions and get the wines right.
So it seems like you like awards, right? You like to collect awards because you not only do you pass the MW, a feat in and of itself, right? You pass it on your first attempt, a sitting. And that's not enough either. You get an award. You get two awards for performance on the exam. How do you feel? Do you feel like Michael Phelps? Do you feel like Michael Phelps after his third Olympics, or?
I don't know how Michael Phelps felt after his third Olympics. I imagine it was pretty darn good. I feel good, yes. I think though, there was an element of surprise because you know that you're surrounded by such a talented pool of other individuals who've taken the exam. In another way, it's validation in a sense. You know, I did work hard enough and I did earn this. I think there's a certain level of scrutiny that comes with earning those sorts of recognitions, though. People expect you to always know the answer, always be correct. And I think the reality is that nobody's ever always correct or always knows the answer. But I feel like it was validation that the process can be. For me, I just would say that the Master of Wine journey was so enjoyable. Because studying and learning and pushing myself is something that brings me great joy. So it was kind of, you know, it was a really positive high five, like, okay, this is, you did do a good job.
Yeah.
You did a good job. And there's evidence of it in some capacity.
So not only are you an MW, I get to say that again, but you are one of only 16 women in the U.S., mm-hmm. right? I think 45 MWs in the U.S., from the U.S.,
so
the majority are men. Mm-hmm. What's that like as a woman, right? You mentioned earlier, too, that, you know, you still go out to a restaurant, the wine list comes and immediately goes to the man at the at the table, and here you are, you've really conquered Mount Everest, or the Mount Everest of wine studies. Mm-hmm. That's got to elicit some kind of emotion in you, right? Is it disappointment? Is it rage? Or do you see a lot of opportunity to improve things?
I guess I should correct. It's not every restaurant. I mean, obviously, when I know the people at the restaurant.
I love hyperbole, by the way.
Yes, exactly. but it's I guess I have mixed feelings about it because on the one hand, I don't want to be viewed differently as a woman because my accomplishment is no different than. You know, a man who becomes a master of wine, and it's just as impressive and just as incredible. I think what it it makes me realize that other people are sometimes surprised. And I would love to change that, because I think that there are a lot of really talented women, young women, particularly, who maybe don't have the self-confidence that I had to push themselves, even when someone says, or someone else doesn't have the confidence in you that they might for another candidate. And I'm not saying that's always because of gender, but it certainly seems like there is a perception that it's shocking that a young woman could become a Master of Wine and win these awards. And I would like to change that, because it's not shocking. It shouldn't be shocking at all. Right. It should be normal.
Right.
And the more women we see, you know, every year there's more more women passing the Master of Wine exam. And it seems as if the year before me, Rebecca Gibb won the same awards that I did. Lisa Perotti Brown, she's an MW who won the same awards that I did. So there are lots of women who are really successful and making waves in the industry. I guess I would just, I would like to be a role model, but also prove that this really, I don't know, I was always the girl on the swim team that would race the boys. I didn't really care if I wasn't supposed to be doing that, or I just always pushed myself because I enjoyed, I don't know, I want to even the playing field a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, let's continue on this. What advice would you give to a young woman pursuing the MW, or with aspirations to pursue the MW, or a young man for that matter? What pieces of wisdom, what nugget could you give them to help them propel themselves through the program? Because not everyone finishes, right? There are people that start off and for one reason or the other end up not finishing the program. Mm-hmm. What kind of advice would you give to someone who to keep their momentum flowing?
Well, I would say the difference between the people who ultimately pass and the people who don't, I would argue that it ultimately comes down to self-belief and having faith in your own abilities and pushing yourself beyond what you think you're capable of. And I would say, absolutely, this is advice that I would give to young women or men or anybody going through. You know, I have mentees that are, you know, 20 years older than me, but I think particularly for women who haven't necessarily been received in the industry in a way that sometimes people question and cause self-doubt, I would just say put that aside. Let it be fuel to your fire, because there's nothing that I love more than either winning someone over or proving someone wrong. And it actually, I think it may have helped me that some people questioned my ability to, I guess people didn't really question my ability. There were many supportive people, but the fact that I sort of felt like an underdog in a way helped fuel the fire. And it made me really, really, really want to do it to the best that I possibly could. And I believed in myself. So I would say, don't let anybody tell you that you can't do something ever. And if you get wines wrong, or if you get knocked down, pick yourself back up and do it again, because you learn far more from your failures than you do your successes. And everybody makes mistakes.
Right.
I have, even the best tasters make really hilarious mistakes. We just hope that nobody ever knows about them. But that would be, just push yourself and believe in yourself. Sort of like you would with sports or with academics or any sort of thing.
That's great. You wrote on, so for the folks that might listen to this and know what the MW is, but maybe not what it takes to become one. So it's a three-part process, right?
Yeah.
It's you pass a theoretical part of the exam, you pass a practical part of the exam, and then you write a research paper. Mm-hmm. You chose to write on, I think, grape growing and winemaking in Napa Valley during Prohibition.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about what you learned from that research paper.
Yeah, it was a fascinating topic, and one that I had to wrestle to find the right lens to look at it through which to look at it. English teacher coming in. Is my grammar correct? Because there was a lot of research on prohibition in general, or production of wine overall. What I thought was fascinating was that there was a perception that sacramental wine saved Napa Valley. Mm-hmm. And originally I became sort of obsessed with that question. And also Napa Valley is so unique and special because we've always been producing wine grapes. We don't really produce other types like table grapes or things like that. And that's been true, you know, back into the 1800s, if you look at the data. So what I thought was interesting was, okay, there are these very clear exceptions in the Volstead Act, right? You can only make wine if you make it for sacramental purposes, for medicinal purposes, or in limitations if you make it at home, right? And originally that definition was, you know, it has to be less than 0.5% of alcohol, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And that ultimately changed. There was a sort of interpretation of the law where it couldn't be intoxicating in fact, right? Which basically meant like you just couldn't look drunk in public and let people know that you made your wine at home. So there was a lot of bootlegging and there was a lot of home winemaking that was driven in large part by European immigrants who, you know, wine was part of their culture. And so anyway, that sort of allowed for me to look at the valley in a very unique way. And what I discovered is that acreage of grape plantings actually grew throughout Prohibition. There were a lot of different factors that affected this. Of course, there was a lot of ripping up of vines and planting other crops. But what I discovered was that there were a lot of things that drove wine production to thrive here. And in fact, it was the home winemakers that really drove that, as opposed to sacramental wine and medicinal wine were really minuscule. Sacramental wine was much more important to Napa Valley than medicinal wine. But, you know, I could go into all of the sort of geeky details. But I think the other thing that was most interesting, and I talked a bit about this with Joel Peterson, who helped me with some of my interviews because he does so much, and now his son, Morgan Twain Peterson, right, who's a master of wine. Right. Congratulations, Morgan, by the way, if you ever listen to this. We talked about this philosophical change in the valley, because what Prohibition marked and what I think was really compelling about the research was that it marked this philosophical shift in making wine for pleasure and making it like art. Really, wine had to become a product that was fit for the economy. Like, we had to plant varieties that were thick-skinned that could travel well. We had to make wine that could travel well. So often it was fortified. And that caused us to lose a little bit of that sort of artistic aspect of winemaking. The business models had to shift because the only way they could legally survive was to, you know, do it the way that the law allowed. And that didn't really change back until the 60s with Mr. Mondavi. I think what I thought was so compelling was there was a lot of love for winemaking and passion for it that really had to stop. And it was put on hold during Prohibition to a certain extent, and then the Great Depression. And we just sort of had a really difficult several decades. And then in the late 50s and 60s, you started seeing that sort of like Napa spirit come back, and people were starting to make wine that turned some heads again. Because prior to, you know, Prohibition, Napa Valley was up and coming. We were starting to make amazing wines. We made amazing wines, but all of that sort of stopped in a way. So that's maybe I went on too long.
No, that's great. It's fascinating. And where can someone read this research?
They can request it from the Institute and have a copy of it, as long as they're not going to publish it or use it. Mm-hmm. Because it's now the property of the Institute of Masters of Wine. So they can ask for it and they can read it, mm-hmm. you know, by the fire, yeah, over a nice glass of Napa
cigar. And yeah,
I find that's the best way to read with lots of wine.
What's it like doing that research paper? I mean, so a lot of the MW program is working with other people, right? It's tasting in groups. It's maybe working with a mentor and mm-hmm. with others, exchanging essays that you're writing. Does it become a very solitary experience when you enter the research paper phase?
Yeah, I would say it's different. I mean, it's always, you're definitely with a group. You have, if you choose to have a study group through the MW program, I mean, ultimately it's an individual pursuit, and you really are alone on exam day. But it's very different when you do the research paper, because you are in libraries or behind a computer screen and you're completely by yourself. I was lucky because I had two other study partners who were going through the program. We passed practical and theory at the same time. And then we were all on the research paper phase together. So we Skyped weekly and we talked about it and we sort of shared our frustrations and all of that sort of thing. But it was invigorating in a sense because, you know, you really get to choose one question that you can go so, so deep on and find, you know, my background was in liberal arts and research, and I've written a lot of research papers, but this one, it sort of took me back to my graduate studies and all of that. So I enjoyed that solo process because you have to find the answers yourself, mm-hmm. Just trust the research and do a lot of typing and rewriting. I think I rewrote my paper 10, 12 times. Wow. Because it has to be good enough. I mean, it has to be publishable. It has to be of a certain level. Anyway, so yeah, it's different, but rewarding in a different way.
Great. Well, congratulations. Sounds like a fascinating topic, and you dispelled a myth that I clung to for some time, and that was that Sacramento wine saved Napa Valley,
I'm
right?
I'm here to keep you honest.
There you are. So, exam week arrives. What does it look like for an MW student on exam week?
Sure. It's the Master of Wine exam is 4 days long. It's quite a trek. What it looks like is sheer terror, basically. But when you get there, you're ready. It's like any game day or swim meet. You know, swim meets were 4 or 5 days long sometimes, so it sort of reminds me of that. But basically, the exam is in the morning for 3 days. You taste wines, and throughout those 3 days, you'll taste 36 wines blind. So you have 12 whites on the first day, 12 reds on the second day, and then 12 mixed bag, they call it, which could be anything. It could be fortified wines, sparkling wines, rosé, sweet, anything goes kind of thing. And honestly, it could be like a vertical of Burgundy. It could be, you know, right bank, left bank Bordeaux. It could be so many different things. So that's what the tasting portion looks like. And then in the afternoon, if you're taking, you know, if say this is your first time taking it and you haven't passed any portion, the theory portion of the exam is in the afternoon, and that's writing essays. So the first day you write three questions on viticulture, right? And so that's basically a closed book, 1,000-word essay on any topic they feel like asking you. The second day is same format, but the topic is vinification or winemaking. And the third day, the afternoon theory portion is they've added this component. It's sort of a QA/QC portion, so that includes bulk wine shipping, sort of the you know closures, packaging, that sort of thing. Maybe not the most glamorous side of the industry, but the nuts and bolts kind of questions. So you know, the year I took it, there was a question on all the considerations that you would need to take when you're shipping wine in bulk from you know X to Y, whether it's U.S. to U.K. or what have you. And the fourth day, you write paper 4 in the morning, which is the business of wine, and in the evening you write paper 5, which is contemporary issues. And that's just sort of, again, it could be wine and health, it could be a question about climate change, it could be a question about, you know, is the wine industry primarily an art or a science or something, you know, that really makes you think. So that's what the week looks like. And really, you're just in for a marathon. You have to go in ready to be on your A game every time you walk in the test room. And the test room is, it looks a lot like the classrooms here, white tables, good lighting. Everybody sets, you have to bring your own glassware, you set up, you know, you're very nervous. They pass around the wines in clear bottles, you pour them for yourself and you can't look at them, you can't start, you can't do anything. And then when the timer goes off, you hear everybody hit their stopwatch. It's this gigantic ding. And then you start smelling and tasting.
So why it sounds like incredibly stressful, right? I mean, you are day one arrives, you're tasting, boom, you have a little break, and then you're going into theory. So you're switching gears.
Yeah.
What's the purpose of that? Why make it such a concentrated, intense experience within? Is there a reason behind that? Or is it just, that's how it's always been done?
Yeah, you know, I can't speak for the people who originally set the exam or the examiners on the, because I'm not one. But I can certainly say that I think that the purpose is, You know, it's very different than getting your master's and, you know, an MBA per se, where you or a college degree for that matter, where you're tested at the end of each semester, mm-hmm. and it's based off of, you know, a certain amount of information. Then you're tested, then you move on. Right. The MW is everything all at once, I think, because that's maybe a true test of mastery of everything altogether. And I think they really want to see people who have part of becoming a master of wine is really becoming a very good communicator. Master communicator, I would say, not on every subject. Good Lord, don't ask me about other subjects. But with wine, you know, part of being masterful is knowing what to leave out. And I think they've set limitations on purpose and give you just a time limit, because if you were asked some of these questions, you could write for days about them. Mm-hmm. But the reality is you have to be able to pick your examples very carefully based off of your own experience and the context that you have, and prove in a short period of time that I have mastered this topic. Mm-hmm. And so I think they, for the theory part, that's sort of it. And the same thing can be applied for the tasting portion. One of the things about the MW that I think is different than any other credential is that we're tested the breadth of what we have to know about the wine business and the amount of wines that we have to taste. You know, 36 wines is a whole lot of wines to taste blind. And it includes everything from White Zinfandel, you know, $3 on your grocery store shelf, to the most expensive Grand Cru of Burgundy. And I think that's the beauty of the credential, because it helps you appreciate wine from top to bottom. Mm-hmm. Far too often, people who work with fine wine maybe turn their nose up at an expensive bottle. But the reality is that those are the bottles that make the world of wine go round. Right. Without being able to talk about all of those different types of wine or analyze them or blind taste them in context, you're really missing a piece. Mm-hmm. So I really enjoyed the studying for the tasting, because it was such a large span. And I think the reason why the Institute asks you to be able to blind taste that range of wines is because they expect you to be able to apply what you know about the world of wine to every aspect of the business.
So you have to be a time management master, right? In the tasting portion,
yeah,
because you need to allocate a certain amount of time to each wine, and then you need to be able to communicate very effectively in a short amount of time.
Exactly.
Is that one of the biggest challenges, is time management?
Oh, absolutely. There's so many people who leave the exam and they didn't finish. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of maybe one of the misconceptions about the exam. When I talk to other people who have done other credentials, sometimes they think we have all the time in the world, right? And 2 hours and 15 minutes for 12 wines is about 11 minutes per wine. But the reality is that anybody who's passed the exam or sitting the exam will tell you this. If you don't know what the wine is after about 2 minutes, you're not going to have enough time to write, because we have to, the writing portion of the practical is so extensive. It's, you know, origin. You have, you know, maybe you have to earn 12 points and you have to prove. You can't just say this is Pulini Moroche Premier Cru, because it is. You have to identify and observe things from the glass in front of you and then translate that into an argument on your page. So you really have to write for about 9 minutes on each wine. And so if you haven't decided what the wine is, or if you're unsure in any way, you'll run out of time. So you have to be, to pass the MW, you have to be on that day very accurate, very fast, and an excellent communicator. And that is what makes it so challenging. And I think the other really piece that's really challenging for people is it has to be across 3 days. Mm-hmm. You can't pass paper one, completely bomb paper two and three, and pass. You have to, it's a combination of the scores. So some people will do really well on paper one and paper three, but then they had a really bad tasting day in the middle, and that draws their total average down and they won't pass. And that's, I imagine, very frustrating, because you're almost there. So that week you really have to be on it for 4 days. I think that's the hardest part.
Sounds excruciating.
Yes,
it's even hard to get out.
it's terrifying even to talk about. And I'm so glad I will never have to sit that exam again.
Yeah, I mean, you must have, you know, been elated when you heard that you did it on your first try, because I can't imagine, like you said, being that person who, you know, you nailed paper one, you know, you nailed paper three, but paper two was your Achilles, right?
Right.
And then you have to come back after all that energy.
But I will say, obviously I was elated. I will say that the character building and the I know many people, most people who have had to take it many times, and the character building, like the toughness, like I have such a great deal of admiration for people who have picked themselves back up and then, you know, they ace it when they pass. You know, Nova is a perfect example of that. She passed both parts. She had to take it many times, and she was one of the toughest, strongest studiers I know. Mm-hmm. So I think there are you gain a lot from that process too. Yeah. No matter how you get there.
What annoys you about the wine business? What's annoying about it? We hear about everything that's wonderful and fuzzy and bunnies about it. What's annoying about it?
I think the most frustrating thing about the wine business for me is some of the snobbery that can surround this, what really is fermented grape juice. You know, I work for a winery that makes some pretty wonderful wine that's also quite expensive and small production. But I can tell you that the people that I work with are grassroots, down to earth. It's really more about farming and producing the best possible product that we can. I wouldn't be able to. That's one of the things that drew me to that place is the passion and sort of the integrity and humility that exists there. Mm-hmm. So for me, I find it frustrating when, you know, I try to be positive a lot, but it really is very frustrating when people try to be pretentious about wine or to use the knowledge that they have to keep someone out rather than bring them in. Because the point of wine is to drink and be merry and bring us pleasure, ultimately. A good friend of mine said once that if wine doesn't bring you pleasure, then it's completely failed. It's the point of wine is to bring us pleasure. And there's a lot of interesting business aspects about it. There's lots of complexities. Sure, there's a lot to know. There's a lot of nuances and the journey of learning never ends. But we should be welcoming people with open arms, not shutting them out because they, you know, haven't, you know, memorized the Grand Crus of Chablis or something. Which there are only 7, so I guess that's not too high of an expectation, correct? But you know what I'm saying. There's an element of humility that I wish I saw a bit more.
Yeah, and you find that humility comes from folks that you encounter that have been educated, or do you think that humility exists in folks who are uneducated, meaning not uneducated in life, but maybe neophytes in wine.
Right, right. Well, I think, you know, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, right? If you know just enough to be dangerous, you may come across, because of your own self-consciousness or you feel like you don't... I don't know exactly what the answer is. I don't know what... It's just a certain attitude that I guess, maybe you find in people who haven't studied as much. Mm-hmm. But I think that's the beauty of working through these credentials is, you know, whether it's the Quartermaster Sommeliers or the WSET or the Master of Wine or the Society of Wine Educators, everybody, I think most people, once you get to the top level, you think to yourself, oh my God, I know. There's so much I don't know, mm-hmm. right? And I would like to hopefully spark that attitude towards people at the very beginning of their journey. Because I was really inspired by people around me, and there were people around me who were humble and who were open-minded and always asked a lot of questions. I was lucky not to be surrounded with someone who tried to intimidate me with wine, and maybe that's what shaped my view. I don't mean to be demonizing of the wine industry, because this is a small sector of folks, but it sometimes permeates into the industry. And I hate seeing that. I think it's detrimental, and we're not going to move forward until we start working together and asking bigger questions.
Good point. Good point. Who would you like to see interviewed on the show? Like, if you could choose two people that you'd like to know and learn more about their journey, who would those people be?
Ooh, that's a good question. Well, there's so many people. Right off the top of my head, a person who I would love for you to interview if you could get him is Gerard Basset. Mm-hmm.
I would love that too.
Yeah, Gerard. He's obviously a master sommelier and a master of wine and an incredible human being to boot. And I think that he has a very unique perspective on what it takes to be at the top. I mean, I think everybody sort of just is in awe of Gerard and his accomplishments. And he also manages to be just so humble and kind and welcoming and supportive of other people studying. So I'd love to hear more about his journey. And I think I can probably think of a million other people. Am I supposed to think of two or one?
One is fine. One is fine. Yeah, I would love to. I think you picked a good one, so
yeah.
We'll go
set
with that one.
Set the bar very high.
There you go. I think that's a theme in your life.
Yes.
So what would you like to accomplish next? I mean, you've accomplished so much, and it doesn't have to be wine-related, but just in general, because it seems to me you're a very goal-driven person. You've got to have your next goal already in your sights. What is that goal?
There are a couple of things that I'm really passionate about. I mean, there's some silly things, like, for example, I used to be a competitive athlete, and let's just state clearly that I have not, I swim like twice a year now, and I run occasionally, and I think pushing myself athletically, maybe doing like a 10K or something. I would never try to do a marathon. That's just never happened.
I had you pegged for Ironman since swimming and running.
No, running, I'm not good at running at all. Biking is, I'm fine at that. But swimming is, maybe I should reframe it, get better at running so I don't look like a ridiculous fool on the side of the road. And two, maybe get back into swimming because it's such a peaceful, calming thing. And those are just personal goals. But I guess the other thing would be, I'm really passionate about animals and rescue organizations. Mm-hmm. And I have a little rescue pup, Mickey,
He's the cutest dog I think I've seen, your one-eyed rescue pup.
My one-eyed rescue poodle, 8 pounds of little apricot fluff. And I guess I'd like to find a way to combine my skills in wine with doing something really good for either, animal rescue awareness. I Monica Stevens is a good friend, and Jameson Rescue Ranch is doing a lot of great things, and I've worked with her a bit, but trying to find a way to help, animals in need.
Great.
Through by way of wine somehow. How can I do this?
I think there's the opportunities are almost endless, right?
Yeah.
So we look forward to having you back and hearing how you did it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's give me a little bit of time before you have me back so I can actually have an answer to that. But
final party question. What wine have you had recently that's totally excited you and that you're just, as someone who's tried so many different wines in your career, is there a wine that you found recently or in the history of tasting that really just cemented in your mind?
Mm-hmm. Well, I won't name a particular wine, but I will say that my travels to Austria recently have solidified my complete and total love affair with Riesling from Wachau. Mm-hmm. And just the incredible potential of, there's already amazing wines coming from that region, but I just really enjoyed listening to sort of the evolution of the region and what's next and sort of how they're identifying quality within that region. I think building awareness on how really amazing, this sounds very like stereotypical wine person, like dry Riesling is awesome. like we need another person shouting that from the rooftops, but evidently we do because, I think there's still a perception that Riesling is always sweet, et cetera. But I would say Wachau Riesling has been extremely, really a wonderful visit and compelling in that sense. But this isn't a new discovery, but I will say that traveling to Burgundy as often as I do, I just white Burgundy is just incredible, mm-hmm. and I would love to see more people experimenting with it. And although it can command quite a price tag, seeking out producers that make really lovely village level wines or Bourgogne Blancs, and just drinking more white Burgundy, those wines are always compelling to me.
Fantastic. Well, cheers to that.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule. You're a busy, busy person. We loved hearing what you had to say, and you have some inspiring words for aspiring students. So
hopefully.
We look forward to having you back. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the show. If you want to find out more or listen to previous episodes, you can go to NapaValleyWineAcademy.com. You can also subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts. You can write to us at listen@NapaValleyWineAcademy.com. And if you want to send us a tweet, it's @NapaWineAcademy. I'm Christian Ogenfuss, and you've been listening to the stories behind wine from Napa Valley Wine.